If you think you know what July 4th is about, think again. It's not just about the Declaration of Independence. There's a whole lot more backstory. And the backstory is fascinating. In fact, we're going to hear all about it today on Generations Radio. I'm Adam McManus, in for Kevin Swanson. My guest is Dan Fisher. He grew up in Van Buren, Arkansas, a graduate of Van Buren High School, West Ark Community College, and Arkansas Tech University. He's the co-pastor of Fairview Baptist in Edmond, Oklahoma, former member of the Oklahoma House of Representatives from 2012 to 2015, ran for governor in 2018, and has authored a very important book that you need to get a hold of through his website, danfisherbrr.com. And the book's name is Bringing Back the Black-Robed Regiment, How the 18th Century Church Stood for Liberty and How We Must Do So Again. Dan tells the inspiring story of the 18th century patriot pastors who preached the biblical principles of liberty in full period costume with verified artifacts from our War of Independence. Now, he and his wife, Pam, have been married since 1981, have two adult children and six grandchildren. His vision is that the American church will regain the spirit of the original black-robed regiment and once again actively engage in defense of truth and liberty. Dan Fisher, a delight to welcome you to the airwaves on this July 4th, 2022.
Adam, it's an honor to be with you. Thank you for having me.
You believe that today pastors in the pulpit are really censoring themselves, aren't they? Why are they doing that?
Yes, they are. A lot of different reasons, but in 2014, George Barna, who's become kind of a friend over the years, did an official study, and he found out that the primary reason is the pastors don't want to cause controversy and they don't want to lessen the offerings in their churches.
The pastors are afraid that if they speak out on the critical, pressing issues of our time, that people will leave. It will hurt their church's attendance.
Yeah, they're afraid it'll hurt their attendance and their offerings.
It's not that they don't know what the Bible says, it's that they don't want to say what the Bible says for fear it'll hurt their attendance and their offerings, when in fact, your experience has been just the opposite. If you preach the truth, people will rally to your cause because it's the biblical cause and they know it's the right cause.
Exactly. And they want to hear the truth about this. I mean, look around us. Our culture is in meltdown. They want to know, what does the Bible say are the answers? So they want to hear it. You better believe it.
In 2008, the Alliance Defending Freedom Group started the Pulpit Freedom Initiative. You were one of the original 33 pastors across the country. What were you tasked to do on that Sunday?
Well, we were tasked to defy the Johnson Amendment because we believe it's unconstitutional, and to endorse candidates from our pulpits, and then to send all of the information to the IRS on that Monday saying, this is what I did in my pulpit, with the hope that they would come after us and then ADF would defend us in court and we'd go all the way, if need be, to the Supreme Court and prove that the Johnson Amendment is squelching a freedom of speech and freedom of religious expression.
Then Senator Lyndon Johnson authored the Johnson Amendment in 1954. It said that nonprofit tax-exempt entities, specifically churches, could not participate in or intervene in any political campaign on behalf of or in opposition to any candidate for public office. I mean, this is, let's be honest with it, this is Johnson trying to dampen the impact that churches would have that are demonstrably on the side of life and family and the political implication that that would mean for him, a Democrat, which even at that time was not on the side of right in many cases.
No. In fact, he had just barely won his first bid for the Senate out of Texas and was being accused of being soft on communism in his second run. And there were a couple of nonprofit conservative groups down in Texas that were bringing this to light, and he was trying to shut them up. So he used his influence in the Senate and shove this through the tax code. And I would imagine, Adam, most people in the Senate didn't even know what they were voting on. It went through so fast. If you look at the congressional record, it's a half a page. That's it. Wow. And it just went right through and been used as a stick to beat anybody who is part of the church or nonprofit pretty much ever since then.
To my knowledge, there's not been one church that's ever been prosecuted for the Johnson Amendment violation, is there?
Never. In fact, I can add to that. A church has never lost its nonprofit status for speaking out on political issues since the IRS was formed.
And to be clear, what you all were tasked to do in 2008 by the Alliance Defending Freedom Group, the 33 original pastors, it's since has gotten much stronger over the years with more pastors participating.
Yes.
But you did something that most pastors never do, and that is you specifically endorsed a given candidate or you specifically opposed a given candidate. We would be happy, wouldn't we, if pastors would simply say, look, Psalm 139, 13 through 16 is very clear. God has developed the child in the womb, and that life is worthy of protection because that life is created in God's image, as it says in Genesis. So any candidate that opposes abortion is the one that you need as a biblical Christian to support. If pastors just said that, or pastors would say, God created Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve, as the foundation yep. of society in terms of the family. We need to reject the homosexual agenda. And any candidate that supports the homosexual agenda, you need to vote against. If they just said those two things, frankly, we would have won a lot more elections in times past, wouldn't we?
I completely agree. In fact, about half of Christians don't even vote. And they all want to know where their pastor stands on these issues. I mean, think about it. They trust the pastor to tell them the truth about how to get to heaven, and they don't want to hear what he believes about the political issues facing our culture. I mean, it's just utterly ridiculous. And here's the thing. When we endorsed candidates from our pulpits, that wasn't an endorsement from the church. That was an endorsement of us, individuals who happen to be pastors. Our church wasn't officially endorsing them. But the Johnson Amendment has been so twisted to say that pastors can't even speak out. Well, we have First Amendment rights just like everybody else.
The Black Robe Regiment is a term of derision coined by the British for the Great Awakening-inspired pastors who really preached on the right of the colonists to resist tyrannical rule. Break down those three words, Black Robed Regiment. What are they talking about there?
Well, the British knew that it was the pastors who were fanning the flames. If we go back to the 18th century, the Christian church was kind of the hub of the culture. And they knew the influence that pastors had. And many of these pastors had been preaching the biblical perspective on proper governance, on the right and responsibility of citizens to engage, spoke out against tyranny, and they were part of the whole process of moving toward independence. I mean, there were pastors fanning those flames. And then when the war breaks out, they're recruiting men from their churches and their communities. And many of these preachers are leading them off literally onto battlefields to fight. And they all preached in black robes in those days. That was just the custom. The British knew all of this, and they were trying to put a target on these guys. So that's why they called them the Black Robed Regiment. Because out of the robes that they preached in, everybody would know what the British were talking about, and they were trying to put the spotlight on these guys to silence them.
So unlike today, when a given Episcopalian priest or a Catholic priest might wear a black robe or a robe of some kind, maybe a Lutheran, very few other Protestants do. Baptists, for example, or Assembly of God, they typically are just dressed either in a suit or very casually today. But in those days, no matter the denomination, a pastor in the pulpit had a black robe, and then they had around their neck something called a preaching band, a white scarf, as it were, with two rectangular vertical pieces hanging down that actually represented the Ten Commandments, interestingly, and how those were about their neck to remind the pastor of the basis for God's revelation to man.
That's exactly right. It was pretty much the dress code of that time. Just like powder wigs were part of the dress code, that's exactly what preachers wore. And like you said, it didn't matter what denomination you were a part of, you would preach in a black robe and you would wear your preaching bands on Sunday mornings.
Now, the regiment, that is a military term. What does regiment mean? And was there really, from the pastor's perspective, an official regiment of pastors?
No, there never was. The reason why they call them the regiment is because they were so outspoken and so effective in mobilizing the colonists to fight for liberty. And of course, as I said, many of these guys actually led them off onto the battlefields. Some of these preachers actually became regular military. Guys like Peter Muhlenberg, eventually, by the time the war was over, was promoted to a major general. And he was one of these preachers. So the British saw them as a major threat. But there was never a regiment of preachers officially. It was the preachers leading regiments. Most of these preachers were part of the militias who served throughout the war and were a critical part of the victory that we won in our independence over Great Britain. But as I said, some of these guys became regular military. So the British saw them as a great threat, and that's why they called them the regiment.
Pastor Peter Muhlenberg was based in Woodstock, Virginia, frontier town, and interestingly was also a member of the Virginia House of Burgesses alongside George Washington and Patrick Henry. He kind of reminds me, Dan Fisher, if I dare say so, I'm going to step out on a limb here, of the very man I'm talking to in light of the fact that you yourself were a pastor, still preaching in the pulpit while you were simultaneously serving in the Oklahoma legislature from 2012 to 2015.
Yeah, and the only reason I stopped serving my third term, I was unopposed, but I was fighting the rhinos so hard that I had to decide, well, am I going to keep doing the black robe and traveling around doing the presentation and pastoring? And just to be honest with you, Adam, I had to give something up, and that was the one that I chose to give. But you're exactly right. See, these men did not believe in compartmentalizing their lives into the secular and the sacred. Now, they didn't suffer from what I call spiritual schizophrenia. They believed their faith should impact every area of their lives. You do everything as unto the Lord. And they felt called to pastor their communities as much as they did their congregations. They saw no conflict whatsoever in serving at every level.
In fact, in 1862, historian John Thornton said that the founding fathers denounced the separation of church and state as ungodly.
Yep. And notice we're told the exact opposite today. We're preached this myth of separation of church and state. And, you know, if I was a lefty, I'd want the pulpit to go silent, too. I would want the Christians to be quiet.
I love the term lefty. Well, among the 56 signers of the Declaration of Independence, many of them were Bible-believing Christians, most of them, in fact.
Yes.
And the only pastor who signed it was John Witherspoon, who actually also happened to be a college president. Tell us a little bit about John Witherspoon.
Yeah, John Witherspoon was a Presbyterian, and in those days, the Presbyterians were very fiery, vocal individuals who were engaged. In fact, King George called it a Presbyterian rebellion to show you how central the Presbyterians were. Now, Muhlenberg, you mentioned a while ago, had grown up as a Lutheran. It was all the denominations. There weren't as many in those days as we have today. Witherspoon was Presbyterian, but he was also the president of the University of New Jersey, which became Princeton. He was also a member of the Continental Congress. And he not only was the only vocational pastor that we know of that signed the Declaration, when the guys were getting a little bit weak in the knees, he got up and gave this impassioned speech that one can go online and read that really emboldened them and kind of pushed them over the edge. And they said, okay, we're going forward. And most people don't know anything about John Witherspoon.
Let's get back to Pastor Peter Muhlenberg in Woodstock, Virginia. Served again in the Virginia House of Burgesses. That was shut down by order of King George III. Virginia's royal governor, John Murray, shut it down, dissolved the House of Burgesses altogether. Muhlenberg was recommended to be commissioned as a colonel by Washington and Henry, raising the 8th Virginia Regiment. Tell us what happened on January 21st, 1776, in Muhlenberg's church.
He goes to his church in Woodstock, stands in front of the congregation wearing his black robe and his preaching bands, and he preaches out of Ecclesiastes chapter 3. There's a time for all things. Goes to verse 8. There's a time of war. Closes his Bible, says there's a time to preach, there's a time to pray, but there's also a time to fight, and that time has come. He steps off to the side, removes his preaching bands and his preaching robe, and underneath
his black
he's
robe.
Wearing his his black robe, sets it aside, and he's underneath he's wearing a colonel's uniform. And he proceeds to recruit the men from his church, and in the ensuing days, men from his community to join the 8th Virginia Regiment. And he leads them off and commands them from 1776 all the way to the end of the war, 1783. fought at most of the major battles. They were a primary part of the fight at Yorktown. Muhlenberg was promoted to major general. His statue is in Statuary Hall in the Capitol building in D.C. today. He's in the painting of Trumbull of the surrender of Cornwallis. I mean, he went all the way to the top.
We're going to take a quick time out. My guest is Dan Fisher. He is the author of an important book that you need to get your hands on, Bringing Back the Black-Robed Regiment, subtitled How the 18th Century Church Stood for Liberty and How We Must Do So Again. Now, you can buy the book for $20 and the DVD or Blu-ray, which is 90 minutes in length, for $20 as well, at his website. I want to give you that to you. It's Dan Fisher, F-I-S-H-E-R-B-R-R, for Black Robed Regiment, danfisherbrr.com. The first five that email me on this July 4th at adam@theworldview.com, Dan Fisher is going to bless you with not just the book, but also the DVD, which is kind of like a docudrama. It is going to be something that will literally captivate your family, your friends. You've got to get a hold of this. And admittedly, only five of you have a chance to do so. So most of you, I would recommend go to the website. But hey, on the off chance that you're one of the first five, send me that email at adam@theworldview.com. Again, the website, Dan Fisher, F-I-S-H-E-R-B-R-R.com. I'm Adam McManus in for Kevin Swanson on this edition of Generations Radio. We'll be right back with an intriguing story of another pastor from the Black Robe Regiment, Jonas Clark from Lexington, Massachusetts. Stick around.
What happens when a culture that was established and guided by biblical principles abandons the faith and seeks to live by its own wisdom? In his latest groundbreaking work, Epic, The Rise and Fall of the West, Kevin Swanson unfolds the dramatic history of Western civilization, highlighting the phenomenal impact that Jesus Christ and his people have had upon the thought, culture, and institutions of the Christian West, as well as tracing the slow but devastating decline of Western civilization and the key factors that have led to our spectacular fall over the centuries. A sobering narrative of gospel hope, this book urges its reader to greater fervency in the work of discipleship and the development of an international vision for the church. This is truly a must-read for any Christian seeking to understand the times and seasons in which we live. You can claim your hardcover copy of Epic, The Rise and Fall of the West, by visiting generations.org/store today. That's generations.org/store.
Welcome back to this edition of Generations Radio. I'm Adam McManus in for Kevin Swanson. My guest is Dan Fisher. He is the author of an important book that you need to add to your family library entitled Bringing Back the Black-Robed Regiment, How the 18th Century Church Stood for Liberty and How We Must Do So Again. His website, danfisherbrr.com. That's danfisherbrr.com. $20 for the book, $20 for the 90-minute DVD or Blu-ray.
Hey, let me also add the first five that do email you, they need to let us know if they want the DVD or the Blu-ray, because we can send them either version. Blu-ray is high definition.
Terrific. Tell us about Jonas Clark in Lexington, Massachusetts, and how he was preaching, and one of his deacons who was training the Minutemen of his own church.
Jonas Clark was the pastor in the church in Lexington, Massachusetts. In fact, his church sat right about where the statue of Captain John Parker stands today. Most people mistake that for the Minuteman statue. That's actually over in Concord. So his church sat right where the road forked. Now, here's the story. He, along with the help of a veteran of the French and Indian War who was a deacon, Captain John Parker, had been training the men of Lexington how to fight together as soldiers. They were calling themselves Minutemen.
They were calling themselves Minutemen because when they heard the church bell ring or toll, they were supposed to be ready within a minute, right?
That's exactly right.
Okay.
So the night, April the 18th, 1775, Paul Revere and a few other riders are going out yelling that the regulars are out. The regulars are coming. He rides directly.
Wait a minute. Let's stop right there. We've always heard that Paul Revere said the British are coming. The British are coming. That has a better ring to it, but apparently that's not historically accurate.
No, because these guys considered themselves Englishmen. We have to remember they did not want to separate from Great Britain. They were proud of their English citizenship. It's just they believed the king had violated the English Constitution and the English Bill of Rights. And they were standing up for their rights.
So what is Paul Revere referencing when he says regulars? Was that a term for the redcoats, the soldiers?
That was a term for the British military. It would be like you and me, if we saw the U.S. Army coming down the road, we wouldn't yell the Americans are coming. We would say the Army is coming or the Air Force or whatever. Well, for them, they called the redcoats the regulars.
Ah.
That's what he's crying. The regulars are out. The regulars are coming. In fact, you remember the story, the old North Church, watching for the lanterns in the steeple, one if by land, two if by sea. So he's part of this spy ring. In fact,
and
the whole story
was it?
Paul
was it,
Revere's
was it
amazing.
Land or sea?
It was sea. They had gone across the harbor on boats. So he and Dawes and a few others are riding out through the countryside. Their job was to alert the citizens. They knew that the redcoats were headed to Concord because they were going there to confiscate weapons. And they had to go right through Lexington. The road forks right there at Jonas Clark's church, the meeting house in Lexington. So Revere rides directly to Pastor Clark's house because not only had Clark been helping to train the Lexington Minutemen, but Samuel Adams and John Hancock were staying with him that night. And oddly enough, John Hancock's grandfather had pastored that very church years before. So here Revere rides up. He yells out to Clark and to Adams and to Hancock, the regulars are coming, guys. Will they go in and have a little council of war? And they decide that the Minutemen in Lexington need to make a show of arms. Now, I don't think they plan to fire on the redcoats because it ended up that they were outnumbered about 10 to 1.
Wow.
Which would have been suicidal.
Wow. Yeah. I had no idea it was that lopsided.
Yeah. See, the regulars, by the second alarm that went out, there were only about 77 or so of the Lexington men that showed up, and there were about 700 to 800 redcoats. And about a quarter of a mile from the church, they had charged their muskets. And so these Minutemen are standing there listening to the sound of 700 to 800 redcoats loading their muskets.
Wow.
So, I mean, if that wouldn't put the fear of God in you.
And it was at 2 a.m. in the morning when Jonas Clark's church bell was ringing, right? I mean, it was in the dead of night.
Exactly. Yes. So here they are standing there, the Minutemen holding their arms in what proverbially is the churchyard to make a show of arms, saying to these redcoats, look, we're not going to give up our liberties without a stand. Unbeknownst to them, as they're told by Captain Parker and Pastor Clark to go on back to their houses, we've made our point, someone discharges a flintlock pistol. And when the pistol goes off, the redcoats take that as a signal to open fire. And initially, they're shooting into the back of the Lexington men as they're walking away on what we call today the Lexington Green. They did what you and I would do. They turned around and defended themselves.
I don't understand the chronology. Why would the Lexington Minutemen not be facing the regulars when there's 700 to 800 of them? So you said they turned their backs at one point.
Well, that's when Captain Parker and Jonas Clark, the pastor, had felt like they had made their point. See, the reason they're standing there is not to fire at the redcoats. In fact, these preachers, oddly enough, it's important you need to understand, the black robe preachers had preached the only war that God could bless was a defensive one on their part. They were not to shed first blood. They were not to fire the first shot. Etched in a granite stone there today are the words of Captain Parker where he said, do not fire unless fired upon. But if they mean to have a war, let it begin here.
But you said there was a shot that rang out. From what side did that shot come?
Well, no one knows, but think about this. Most people who were common everyday individuals, which is what the Minutemen were, did not own pistols. Typically, that was the weapon of a commander. Most likely, this was one of the redcoat commanders, whether the pistol went off accidentally, he had had it drawn and was waving it in the air, and it accidentally goes off. No one knows, but everyone there said it was the report of a pistol. Obviously, they sound different from a long gun. And they
but
had a little more.
Most people had
pop.
The long guns.
Oh, yeah. Of course, all the regulars and all of the Minutemen, they're all carrying the long flintlocks. When that shot goes off, the Minutemen are walking away because they've been told to disperse. They've made their point. They've shown the redcoats, we're not going to just roll over and play dead. But unfortunately, the Redcoats, who've just loaded their muskets a quarter of a mile back down the road, they take that as a signal to open fire, and they begin to shoot the Minutemen. And that's when the Battle of Lexington begins.
And at that point, Jonas Clark is looking over the Lexington Green, and eight of his men from his own church are dead, and others are wounded. It must have been a very somber, solemn moment for him.
Well, he had told Samuel Adams and John Hancock and Paul Revere the night before. They asked him, would the men fight? And he said, I trained them for this very hour, and they will fight, and if need be, die too, under the shadow of the house of God. So he saw eight of the Lexington men. I'm not sure all of them were members of his church, but they were from Lexington, were killed, and another 10 were wounded in what we would call a skirmish. It didn't last probably more than 15 minutes or so. It was the beginning. And then, of course, the British go on to Concord, and there's another preacher up there named William Emerson, and he encourages the men to, if they're going to die, let's die here. And, of course, they fight the British at the Old North Bridge.
Let's talk about some of the other members of the Black Robe Regiment. My guest is Dan Fisher, author of the book Bringing Back the Black Robe Regiment, How the 18th Century Church Stood for Liberty and How We Must Do So Again. James Caldwell, who is he?
James Caldwell was a Presbyterian preacher in Elizabethtown, New Jersey. And he, like many Presbyterians, was very fiery. He had tried his best to insult the British and would say things in his pulpit like, sometimes it's more righteous to fight than it is to pray. And so they put a bounty out on him. And every Sunday, he would walk into his pulpit with a couple of loaded pistols, flintlock pistols, and he would lay them on his pulpit and preach. And then he was finished. He'd take the pistols, hook them back in his belt, and greet his congregation. And when the British invade Elizabethtown, one of the Redcoats jumps over the fence of the Caldwell home and shoots Hannah, his wife, through the window, hits her in the chest, kills her instantly in cold blood.
All right, let me ask you about this. When I first learned about this story, I was horrified. I mean, this seems to be in direct opposition to a traditional rules of conduct in a military situation. You don't shoot at civilians, much less a woman, through a window in her own home. I mean, was this typical of the British soldiers, or was that man totally devoid of any conscience, unlike his British colleague?
Adam, I don't know. Here's what I will tell you. Typically speaking, when the British would go into a town or a village and they would occupy it, they would either desecrate the churches. Oh. For instance, in some of the churches in Boston, they turned them into horse stables and even had horse competitions inside the old South Church. Or they would burn them. In Warren, Rhode Island, the pastor there, Charles Thompson, they not only burned his church, they burned his house.
Was now, King George III the leader of this kind of hostility to church and Christianity, or were they just so upset with the colonists for daring to speak up?
Yeah, I think that's what it was. I don't think probably King George would have ordered that. He was a tyrant, but I don't know that he was that kind of a bloodthirsty tyrant. But you get these troops 3,000 miles from Great Britain and get them in North America, and, you know, these guys are insulted. They think that these Minutemen are turncoats, and they see them as rebels. Some of those Redcoats and some of those commanders were pretty irate. I mean, you take, for instance, General Thomas Gage, when he was put in charge of Massachusetts. Boy, he cracked down on the pastors and made it pretty difficult on them. And in my book, I tell stories of what some of these commanders did to some of these preachers when they would occupy these little communities. I mean, it's just heart-wrenching when you go through and read these little vignettes in my book. My gosh, this was a more brutal experience than we may think. We've kind of sterilized it in our minds, and we just have troops lined up facing one another in open fields, and there's a little more to it than that.
So what happened after James Caldwell's wife, Hannah, was shot and killed through the window? How did he respond?
Well, he was actually watching through a telescope at a distance the occupation of Elizabethtown. He just couldn't see that happen, but he overheard that night some men around a campfire mentioning Mrs. Caldwell. And so he went up to them and said, what are you talking about? And he forced them to tell him she'd been killed.
Oh, no.
So the next day he rides into Elizabethtown under a white flag of truce, sees his wife's body, which was snatched from their burning house because they burned her house or the Caldwell house. A neighbor pulled her body out and put her body in his house. And there was Caldwell's children and his dead wife.
Oh.
And then he helps to kind of eulogize her at her funeral and then leaves the kids in care of the townsfolk. And he goes off to Springfield, New Jersey, where the men are fighting the British there. And that's where they run out of wadding for their muskets.
Now, what is wadding and why is that essential?
Well, the wadding is the paper that typically the round and the gunpowder was wrapped in. They would pre-prepare these little cartridges. You'd bite the end off of it, turn it down your flintlock barrel, and the powder would come out. And then the ball wrapped in the paper that remained, you'd shove that down into the barrel, and that will hold the shot tight so that when you fire it, it will have more force and power behind it and give it that force that it needs to fly out of there and, you know, travel 50 to 100 yards and hit the desired target.
What was Caldwell's solution?
So he jumps on his horse and he rides down to the First Presbyterian Church of Springfield. Now, he doesn't pastor this church, but he rides down to there, runs inside and begins to grab hymnals. And those hymnals were filled with hymns written by a famous songwriter of those days named Isaac Watts.
Oh, yes. And we sing a number of his hymns in our home.
Of course. When I Survey the Wondrous Cross is an Isaac Watts hymn. So he rides back to his men. He begins to throw the hymn books out of his men, telling the men to tear out the pages and use the pages for wadding. So as they do so, they're firing away at the British, and that preacher standing there throwing out hymn books, yelling to his men, "Give them Watts, boys, put Watts into them." And yeah.
That's fantastic.
Sadly, not long after that, a man that most people believe the British had hired caught Caldwell unarmed and shot him and killed him in cold blood, just like they'd killed his wife.
Oh, no. Yeah. Tell us about the president of Yale, who organized 100 of his students to fire a number of shots on the British. What was his name and what happened to him?
Well, Naphtali Daggett was not only a pastor or a preacher, but he served as the president of Yale, which is located in New Haven, Connecticut. So when the British attacked New Haven with the intent, of course, of occupying it, he and about 100 boys from the school ride out to meet the British to fire a number of shots. They're not trained militia or military or anything. These are just young men with guns. And the reason why they wanted to slow the advance of the British is to give the people in New Haven a chance to get out of town. So as they're firing away at the British, just probably a handful of shots at the most, he's there leading them, and the British capture him. Rather than just treating him honorably as a prisoner of war, they beat him so brutally, dragged him through town, that eventually, a number of months later, having never recovered from his wounds totally, he dies. He dies of his wounds. And now we're talking about the president of Yale.
Right.
And a pastor. So this shows you the incredibly antagonistic attitude that the Redcoats had about these preachers, because they really did believe the preachers were the reason they were fighting the war.
I'm reminded of another president of a very famous school that once had a vision to train young men on preaching the gospel. They've since abandoned it, of course, years ago. Samuel Langdon, president of Harvard.
Yes.
He was very patriotic, and he was really rubbing the Tory students the wrong way there, wasn't he?
He was. And if you look at the original motto of the school, it was for truth and the church and for Christ. Now Harvard only just says they exist for truth. They've changed their motto, but it's still on some of the original gates. The Johnson Gate, for instance, I think was built maybe in the 1880s, it still has the full motto for truth and Christ in the church.
Well, really?
Because they were training preachers.
Truth be told, they should change their motto for the lies from the pit of hell. That's what they should change it to.
No, you are exactly right. We've lost this understanding. People don't know all of this, and that's why this is so important that we bring this back.
Samuel Langdon, the former president of Harvard, resigned, virtually compelled to do so in 1780, became a pastor of the Congregational Church in Hampton Falls, New Hampshire. I thought that was interesting. But
yes.
The bottom line here, Dan Fisher, is this. As people can hear the wide range of the Black Robe Regiment and the folks who were leaders in the educational elite, all siding with the Lord's call for responsibility against tyranny, this was not a group of rabble-rousers.
No, and it's not just a handful. They were all over the colonies. And like you said, many of them were men of tremendous influence. These aren't just backwoods fist fighters who decided they wanted to go out and enjoy a really good brawl with the Redcoats. These are leaders. These are men that are president of Yale and Princeton and members of the Continental Congress. good grief.
Talk to us about Pastor John Treadwell of Lynn, Massachusetts.
John Treadwell was a pastor who was cut out of the same piece of cloth, and we're told that he kept a loaded flintlock musket. So we're talking about a long arm now, leaning against his pulpit, and every Sunday when he would go up to preach, he had his cartridge box under one arm and his Bible under the other. And so I'm assuming he'd lay his cartridge box on the pulpit and proceed to preach. Most of these men knew that at any given moment, the Redcoats could literally invade their church and arrest them or take them out in the churchyard and shoot them. You know, when Caldwell would wear his pistols, he had men of his church up in the bell tower and the steeple and outside watching for the British.
Wow.
Because they knew how brutally they would be treated if they were captured. Some of these guys were murdered by the Redcoats while they were trying to surrender on the battlefield.
Wow. Tell us about Pastor Thomas Allen in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, and what made him unique in the Battle of Bennington in Vermont.
Yeah, you know, I chuckle when I think about him because I think out of all of the preachers, he's kind of the quintessential. I mean, you'd think it's Peter Muhlenberg, and maybe he is. But Thomas Allen is a perfect picture of the fighting spirit in these guys. He was not only the chaplain of the Pittsfield Minutemen, but he was also the commander. These guys believed they were standing up for truth and liberty. It's not just that they wanted to go out and shoot people. In fact, Adam, I have excerpts of some of these men's letters in my book. They were terrified by what was happening and hated and regretted that they had to do this. But it was either that or knuckle under, and who knew what kind of tyranny they would live under. The Battle of Bennington, Vermont, he leads his men out on the battlefield wearing his preaching robe. And once he positions his men, he walks out into the killing zone between the two armies, jumps up onto a stump, and offers the British the opportunity to surrender before his men open fire.
Wow.
And some of the Redcoats, who are probably Tories, recognize him, and they said, well, there's Preacher Allen, somebody ought to pop him. And they fired a volley of musket fire at this preacher and missed him, put a hole in his hat. So he goes back and stands beside his brother Joseph. Joseph loads and Thomas Allen fires, and they fight all day long at the Battle of Bennington, Vermont, brother beside brother.
When he returned to the church, he was questioned by one of his parishioners. Wait a minute, you're a pastor. You were involved in battle. What did he say in response?
So after the battle, he helps to care for the wounded. But toward the end of the week, he has to saddle up and ride back to his church because he has to preach. And an irate church member confronts him when he gets there and says, what were you doing fighting over there? Allen said, well, every man had to do his duty, and I did mine. And then his church member said, well, you're a preacher. Surely you didn't kill anybody. And Allen said, well, I don't know if I killed anybody, but I noticed behind a particular bush that there was a frequent flash. And every time that flash occurred, one of our men would fall. So I took steady aim and shot at that bush. I don't know if I killed anybody, but I put out that flash.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
I bet that church member were like, I don't have a response for that.
Wow. I think I'll just go sit down.
Now, parenthetically, Thomas Allen's brother Moses was captured and was on one of these prison ships. How many prison ships did they have? And was Moses himself a pastor?
Yeah, he was a preacher. And I think Moses was a pastor as well. Adam, I don't know exactly how many of these ships that they had, but I do know this. There were over 12,000 patriots that were placed on those prison ships.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And in case your listeners don't know, what these were floating prisons. They would take decommissioned ships that they no longer wanted to use, they meaning the British, they would anchor them in the harbor and shove these guys in these ships, into the belly of these ships, and basically keep them below deck the whole time. Just gave them horrible treatment. And the highest death rate was among the preachers that they captured, because they put those preachers right on those prison ships. Charles Thompson, the preacher over at Warren, Rhode Island, that I mentioned earlier, that they burned his church and his house, they captured him and threw him on one of these prison ships.
What happened to Moses when he tried to escape and went overboard to try to swim ashore?
These guys were malnourished and were sick because they gave them horrible food and no medical attention. Well, he jumped overboard hoping that he could swim to shore, but he just greatly underestimated how weak he had become, and he drowned. We're told that the Redcoats stood right there and watched as this preacher drowned in the water, and then when his body floated to the top, they threw his body over on the bank within eyesight and obviously smell of the other soldiers as his body lay there and decayed as a part of the punishment of the other guys.
You also address how there are some interesting parallels between America today and pre-World War II Germany in terms of the churches that had gone silent.
Yeah. The German church had become very decadent, much like the American church has. And there were people within the church in Germany that were committed, and one of those was a man named Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was a Lutheran preacher. In fact, a number of his discipleship books are still used today in churches around the world. But the church in Germany pretty much went silent. Many of the churches, especially the official Catholic Church, they tried to stay neutral and tried to make deals with the Nazis. Of course, they didn't work out so well, obviously. Finally, Dietrich Bonhoeffer was actually here in America, and he decided to go back to Germany to stand with his people and participated in a number of attempts to assassinate Hitler, and they finally captured him. About 2 weeks before the Allied forces liberated his camp, they hanged Bonhoeffer with a piano string.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I never knew that.
So what? Yeah, it's terrible. Bonhoeffer today is, you know, lionized and is a hero among many in Germany, and there are memorials to him. But in those days, of course, the Nazis considered him part of public enemy number one. I often say that I think what the church in Germany did is it just waited too long to speak up. I'm fearful that's what's happening today in America.
You have said that the church is the conscience of the culture. The pastors are the voice of that conscience. But when the conscience goes silent, what happens to the culture? And I think we can see it between the crazy transgender agenda just recently in the headlines. A 29-year-old man pretending to be a woman competed with preteen and teen girls in a skateboarding competition. This is what's happening. Yeah.
Well, in Olympic competitions, you have men competing as women, and in swimming competitions, they dust these gals. And it's only because the men are just physically stronger and they're larger. They're being awarded awards that should be going to actual women. And young girls all over the country are going to start losing scholarships or the opportunity for a scholarship. I mean, you can just imagine what this is going to do to female sports. Just imagine someone like Michael Jordan playing on a woman's team in a woman's league. I mean, for Pete's sake, those gals wouldn't have a chance, even though they're great ball players in their own right. We recognize the difference between the sexes. And of course, that's just one of the horrible symptoms of our culture.
Well, let's speak to the other big one, which is abortion.
Okay.
It was overturned on Friday, June 24th. My gut is that too many pastors think, well, phew, now that's over. We can not ever have to talk about that again. But indeed, the battle is just beginning in post-Roe America, not only because a number of states are going to become abortion hubs where there will be abortion tourism, and there will be more abortions in that state than there's ever been in the history of that state, whether it be California or New York, just to cite two obvious examples. But here in Texas, for example, where we had the ongoing Heartbeat Act in place and it was saving many babies, there are still women who are going to get pregnant outside of wedlock in particular, looking to get an abortion. No, they can't get one legally here, but if they are able to travel, and many of these companies, these leftist companies
these corporations,
Amazon and Citibank and Bank of America, and on the list goes, will pay for them to travel to a state where they will kill the baby. I mean, this underscores the importance of Christians paying for ultrasound machines and crisis pregnancy centers so that when the woman is first thinking about abortion and willing to travel to a state that does not make it illegal, she can see that child on the screen in her womb. She can hear the heart beating. We have a chance to save that baby's life and save that woman's life from the psychological, physical, and emotional and spiritual damage she will suffer from for years ahead.
And a large number of women who see that ultrasound immediately choose not to murder their baby.
78%.
Yeah. Roe v. Wade did not end abortion. All it did was end the federal control. It goes back to the states.
Okay, I want to give you 1 minute. You're talking with one pastor who has heretofore not said much about the quote-unquote social issues, the family, abortion, gender, sexuality. Those are some of the key ones. Pornography, perhaps. What would you say to them that would echo the Black Robed Regiment of the 18th century?
We cannot compartmentalize our lives and just preach about the things we want to. We have to preach the whole counsel of God, number one. The Bible is clear about all these things. Number two, Ezekiel tells us, speaking first person for God, that if the watchman on the wall sees the enemy approaching and he sounds the alarm and no one listens, he's free. But if he sees the enemy approaching and he does not sound the alarm, God will hold him personally accountable for everything that happens from that point on. Preachers are watchmen on the wall. How could we stand in front of our people and ignore clear admonitions from God's word and stand by while our culture disintegrates into a godless mess? We're going to stand before God, and James says that the pastors will face harsher judgment than anyone else because they knew it and didn't do anything about it.
You, in your presentation, your live presentation, and I hope there are generations, listeners all across America and even around the world, because we have listeners in other countries, they will reach out to you through your website, danfisherbrr.com, and invite you to speak. Dan Fisher, F-I-S-H-E-R, B-R-R for Black Robe Regiment, danfisherbrr.com, and invite you to speak. You give a phenomenal in-person presentation where you are in literal period piece costumes and you take on the personas of many of these very pastors whom we've described, and you use artifacts that were actually there in the midst of the Revolutionary War period. Describe that, if you would.
I believe that people needed to hear this story when I first heard about it a few years ago. And so I just started doing the presentation. It has morphed into kind of a one-man Broadway production. Multimedia, large screen, sound effects. As you said, relics from the war. We know the soldiers' names that carried these flintlocks. I have one that was used at Bunker Hill. I have one that was crossed the Delaware with George Washington and was used at the Battle of Trenton, New Jersey. So in period costume, to kind of bring the story to life, I act and become some of these guys. I tell their story. It's about an hour-long presentation. I don't mean to sound presumptuous, but it is captivating, and people will applaud. They will weep. And everybody tells me, everywhere I go, everyone in America needs to hear this story. Because it's not my story. It's a story of the preachers and their congregations of the 18th century. There would not be the republic we know of today had it not been for the church of the 18th century.
How, for example, did you get that musket from the private soldier Isaac Cook, who crossed the Delaware River on December 25th, 1776? I mean, did someone who inherited that give it to you? Did you buy it? What happened?
A few years ago, a foundation from your state in Texas attended one of my presentations. I didn't know they were there. And on my way home, they called me and they helped to fund a lot of the things that we're doing. So one of the things they've helped us to do is to amass this little traveling museum that I have. That flintlock was owned by a man who is a historian and a collector himself up in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. He's become a good friend. And every now and then I can talk John into selling some of his own personal stuff. You know, he trades and deals in these, but he has his own collection. And that was one of the ones that he had in his collection for many years, and he knew the story behind it. In fact, Isaac Cook's name and initials are stamped into the gun himself.
Wow.
But I have others where the guys carve their names in. What it does is it brings this right down to life. You know, normally you're looking at these things through thick glass. Well, at my events, I have the people hold them. I mean, they're standing there holding their history. They've got their cell phones out taking pictures of them holding a flintlock that crossed the Delaware with George Washington.
Well, I want to encourage folks to not only invite you to come and speak at their church or at their event, but go online and take a look at his schedule, danfisherbrr.com. I'm in San Antonio, and I see that you're coming to Austin in the end of August. And I told my wife, we are going to be there. I want my three kids to see this. I want them to meet him. I want them to touch these guns. I want to get excited about our American history because it's something to be proud of.
Adam, when you stand there holding a flintlock, that was there. And then you put your hand right where that soldier after the battle carved his name into it in August of 1777 outside of Oriskany, New York. He'd used it at the Battle of Oriskany. Adam Miller was his name. And you put your hand over that carving and you know that he was sitting under a shade tree somewhere in the state of New York after the battle, carving his name into this stock. I mean, it doesn't get any better than that for people who love history.
You have said, I am convinced that the church, had it not done what it did in the Revolutionary War period, that we would be living in a very different America today.
For instance, John Witherspoon in the Continental Congress, what if he had not given his impassioned speech when the delegates were getting really fearful? Would they have gone ahead and voted to declare our independence, or would they have retreated backwards? You see, we don't know. What about Jonas Clark, who pastored the church in Lexington, Massachusetts, where the first official shots of our War of Independence were fired? What if he and Deacon John Parker had not been training those men? What if they hadn't taken their stand that morning on April the 19th, 1775? What if Pastor William Emerson up there in Concord later that day had not been standing there with the militia up on Barrett Hill overlooking the old North Bridge and had not encouraged them, if they're going to die, let's die here? What if they hadn't done that? Maybe things would have turned out very differently. What if Peter Muhlenberg had not become the commander of the 8th Virginia and had recruited the men from his community to go out and fight? I mean, the British were convinced that it was the preachers who were the primary reason, and this is why they were so harsh and brutal to these men. I mean, preachers like John Rusbrugg, who is trying to surrender at the Second Battle of Trenton a week after the first battle, he's trying to surrender to the Hessians commanded by a British officer, and they murder him. Mm. This is the kind of conviction that these people had. I believe our history would be very, very different. I actually depict John Rusbrugg being killed. It's kind of the closing act of my presentation. And man, I have people weeping during that section. But it's moving. My gosh.
Oh, yes. If you want to get the book, it's $20, the DVD or Blu-ray, 90 minutes in length, a docudrama where it's not just his stage presentation. He is in uniform and dramatically portraying many of these pastors from the Black Robe Regiment, but you also hired a number of actors and reenactors. And so this is something that you want to get your hands on. Again, the website where you can purchase both, danfisherbrr.com. That's Dan Fisher, F-I-S-H-E-R, B as in boy, R-R.com. And remember, the first five people who email me at adam@theworldview.com on this Independence Day 2022 and request a copy of a free book and a free DVD or Blu-ray, please specify. Once I get those addresses and names, I will send them off to Dan, and Dan will send your prize pack, as it were, off to you. Dan, I want you to close us with a 30-second prayer for this country and for the pastors in particular.
I would be honored. Father, thank you so much for the liberty that comes ultimately from you. We know every good gift is from above, and liberty is definitely a good gift. Lord, we have squandered in many ways that gift, and the church is set by silent, afraid of whatever, the IRS, afraid of controversy. Lord, forgive us. On our watch, millions of babies have been murdered before they were ever able to even draw a breath of air. And God, this happened on our watch. Liberties by the multitudes are being stripped away. Father, we must speak out. Thank you for our heritage. Not everyone in our history was perfect. Our country's not perfect. But thank you for our heritage. Thank you for these preachers in the 18th century that the British called the Black Robed Regiment. Thank you that they stood. Now help us in this modern era to stand. Help pastors to grow a spine again. No one wants a war of bullets and bombs, and we're not asking for that. But Lord, we're a culture war. We're a war for the soul of this republic. And I pray that the preachers would lead and stand up, speak out boldly, and preach the truth unapologetically. Lord, if we do, I believe you will hear from heaven and you will heal our land. And I pray it in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen. The name of the book, Bringing Back the Black Robed Regiment, How the 18th Century Church Stood for Liberty and How We Must Do So Again. Dan Fisher, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, thank you so much, Adam. Thank you for having me. If I can ever be of any help, please call upon me.
I welcome emails to me about this particular conversation. What sparked your curiosity? What got your attention? What did you learn as a result of hearing this edition of Generations Radio? Send me an email to adam at theworldview.com. Adam at theworldview.com. I'm Adam McManus, in for Kevin Swanson on this edition of Generations Radio as we lay down a vision for the next generation.